Should environmental history courses have a narrative? A roundtable discussion on teaching environmental history. And I speak with Alan McEachern about Canadian environmental history textbooks. I'm Sean Courage, and this is Episode 6 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Environmental history has become a staple of university course calendars across the country. NISHA's own directory of undergraduate courses offered in Canada includes more than 70 different courses. As the field matures and more students engage in environmental history research at both the undergraduate and graduate levels, it's important to reflect on how we teach environmental history. We've seen examples of this in articles by James Feldman, Lynn Heasley, Nancy Langston, and Michael Lewis in Environmental History, the Journal, over the past couple of years. This episode of the podcast hopes to add to this conversation about teaching environmental history. I recently sat down with three professors from the University of British Columbia to collectively discuss our own teaching experiences and share some ideas. I'm joined now by two professors here in the Department of History at UBC, Professor Tina Liu.
Hello, Sean.
And Professor Eagle Glasseye.
Hi there.
And we're here this afternoon to talk about teaching environmental history. We have prepared some questions for a discussion ahead of time to get some ideas from each other on different approaches to teaching environmental history. So Tina is going to lead us off.
Right. Well, this comes at a good time because now that's the end of the term, I have to think about what I'm going to teach in the fall. And as I'm teaching for the first time for me an environmental history survey course in the environmental history of North America, it occurred to me whether or not that whole enterprise of teaching a survey course in environmental history was a contradiction in terms. And that led me to think about how you'd go about balancing chronology with thematic coverage. So how do you give students a sense of change over time and what that looks like from the perspective of environmental history, while also hitting on some of the big themes that environmental historians have been studying. So that was on my mind, and as well as the usual historical questions about what's the right temporal and spatial scale for an undergraduate environmental history course. And I should say that this course in environmental history is at the upper division, and we might talk a bit, I hope, about upper division teaching versus first and second year teaching. So that was the question that I started with. And I suppose, Sean, since you actually taught this course last year, I would look for you to give me some ideas about how I should teach it so I don't start reinventing the wheel and we can go from there. I'd really be interested.
Well, I thought it was a good question about how do you balance chronology and a thematic approach to teaching the course. And I guess what I strived to do when I taught it this year was to have a chronothematic approach to teaching the course. So I thought that there was a larger narratives in environmental history that we can apply, but then there are these key themes that cross a bigger chronology that may deal with a really earlier period and may deal with a really later period that you can then deal with thematically as a whole. And so those kinds of topics I saved for later in the course, and topics that fit more neatly with a pattern of chronology from week to week I dealt with earlier in the course. I should say that we are joined now by Professor Matthew Evenden from the Department of Geography, who's joining in on the conversation. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks. Sorry, I'm running a little late.
That is okay. We're just talking about chronology versus thematic approaches to teaching environmental history. So I began with talking about a little bit of the geological history of North America as a sort of deep history and an introduction to environmental history. So I tried to fold those two things in together and move from there to discussing patterns of environmental change in Aboriginal North America prior to contact with Europeans. And then we moved into talking about ecological imperialism. And so there was a sort of chronological logic to those themes that I could use, but that breaks down later on in the course when we get to cities and water and topics that are more strictly thematic but could leap in time depending on what kind of case study I used. So I tried to blend the two.
It seems to me that that within different themes or case studies, chronology is embedded. And so if you're interested in teaching change over time, that you could cover just with a narrower case study or sort of set of case studies around a particular theme, you could cover the notion of change over time. You could go quite far back and be talking about everything from geological time to you know, human political time, if you want to think of it that way. And so that I don't know that those approaches are mutually exclusive. I think that if you're talking about chronological thinking as a kind of a skill that you're trying to develop, that it could be integrated with a thematic approach, which is what I've been leaning towards in all of my courses, not just my environmental historical teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to address that directly, Eagle and I had the challenge but also the pleasure of designing a first year global environmental history course where I think we tried to do exactly that. We thought global. Neither of us is a historian of global history or world history. How can we approach this? And so we did start with themes, and those themes were climate, agriculture, energy, and cities. And within those themes, obviously, there were certain arguments about change over time that we wanted to address from the perspective of agriculture, how different forms of agriculture changed the land and water and all those sorts of things over time. But so that worked quite well. And then there were some themes that were overarching and that encompassed all four themes. And I think one of the big ones for us was simply to map out the increasing separation of people from the environment, to map out that alienation and then the kind of episodic reconnections and the context in which they occurred. So again, that was a kind of chronological thematic approach. Now it was selective because we did only have four themes, mm-hmm. but it was a way of kind of juggling a very large spatial scale within a 13-week period at a first year level. So that was one of the ways that we tried to do that.
Well, maybe that gets at your question about teaching introductory courses versus mm-hmm. upper level courses. Is it more important to construct a chronological narrative for an introductory course than it is for an upper level course? Is it easier to take a thematic approach to teaching environmental history for, say, a 300 or 400 level course?
I would lean towards a thematic approach for introductory courses as well, in particular because I think introductory courses, regardless of the discipline or sub-discipline, really need to develop the skills that are involved with that particular discipline or sub-discipline, and mm-hmm. sort of get students ready for upper level courses where they're going to have to ask certain kinds of questions. They're going to have to use certain kind of analytical tools. And so just as an example, you could in an introductory course, you could have as one of your recurring themes something about the relationship between the material world and the discursive constructions of the material world. And I think environmental history is a place where that can be done quite productively if perhaps with the same kind of problems that you might have reconciling the material and the discursive in other subfields. But that's a kind of way of looking at things. You know, how does the stuff out there relate to what we think is going on out there? So Tina and I, in our course, we've had quite a bit of focus on what we called ways of seeing. And so you could have a river, and we had what I thought was a quite productive tutorial exercise on rivers, where Tina had collected a whole variety of sources on a couple of different rivers, or was it the same?
Right. I think it was the Peace and the Columbia, probably.
Yeah. And there are different kinds of sources, different kinds of ways of looking at the river, or different constructions of what the river is. One had to do with energy potential. One had to do with recreation. Mm-hmm.
I had a sound file.
A sound
file. Which was just, you can buy those CDs that are essentially white noise, but you can buy The River, or you can buy Wolf Howls, or you can buy Rain. But I thought here's a manifestation of The River, at least from the perspective of Nature Sounds Incorporated, and that is one way of looking at a river. And we just had the students listen to that as well as read all this other stuff.
Yeah, so there it's a kind of we're asking the students to think about how the physical river might relate to the uses that are made of it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a skill that would be very useful to a student going on in environmental history or in other fields as well. Mm-hmm. And so I would lean towards, in my own teaching at the introductory level, to developing skills, looking at certain themes, and not necessarily trying to cover a particular body of knowledge. But that's the general direction my teaching has gone towards, mm-hmm. something that's mm-hmm. that's called by some scholars uncoverage, which it's
right.
a play on words. It's both. Getting away from coverage, as in there's a particular body of knowledge, and the idea that when we look at sources, we uncover, we kind of ask questions and kind of peel away the surface meanings into looking for deeper meanings. Anyway, so it's kind of a broader pedagogical, philosophical point.
I think I've caught my breath now, so I can maybe jump in. I mean, what strikes me as a basic challenge in setting up survey courses or introductory courses in environmental history is trying to work out what the connection will be to the region or the scale of analysis. And I think the fallback position so often is that it has to fit in some kind of national framework or continental framework. And what follows from that is a series of assumptions about the political narrative that has to be addressed, and that comes with a certain chronology and so forth. And maybe if we just move away from that assumption that there won't necessarily be a course in Canadian environmental history or North American environmental history, it does liberate us in a number of ways. And if the question is, do we cover a core set of issues and problems that might make up the kind of canon of an environmental history survey or the core of an environmental history survey, it seems to me that we might consider some of the basic and most important contributions to of environmental history as a field to general historical scholarship. And I can think, for example, of the concept of ecological imperialism is breaking open a whole new set of ideas about cultural encounter and global exploration and cultural exchange. And that is a useful topic, I think, to introduce students to some of the complexities of environmental historical analysis, some of the classic texts, and some of the ways in which a clear focus on environmental problems does help to open up other fresh questions about cultural and social processes. But the basic conundrum is always how the class fits into a broader program,
mm-hmm.
what demands are made of you in terms of national coverage,
mm-hmm.
How students respond to that. They may mm-hmm. want to learn about a particular country's environmental history. They may not.
Right.
So all these things have to be worked mm-hmm. out in particular locations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I felt a compulsion, at least, to try and have a story that was told in the course so mm-hmm. that at the end of the course, students had a sense of a beginning and end, which is why I'd hoped that the end of the course brought us up to the present. Because I had framed the course initially as a way of understanding contemporary environmental issues and historicizing them. And so I thought that the course itself should have some kind of story about, because we were restricted to North America as a geographic area, then a history of human relations with non-human nature in North America over a particular period of time. And so I hoped that by incorporating some chronology into the structure of the course, students could then take our final week where we discussed climate change and reflect on the couple of weeks where we dealt with progressive conservation and think about change over time in the relationship between humans and non-human nature and how we get to a point of dealing with issues of global climate change and carbon emissions and greenhouse gas effects, and whether or not we can see legacies or changes in attitudes to non-human nature when compared to progressive conservationists at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. So I don't know how effective this was by the end of the course, whether or not you could make those connections, but I strove to try and see if there was a coherent narrative, especially in terms of historicizing contemporary environmental issues.
That's really interesting because you ended with climate change. Eagle and I started with climate change in our first year course as a kind of, I think in part because it was a first year course. It's a course that falls under the rubric of contemporary issues in historical perspective. So I think when we were considering how to structure it, we thought we would begin with what we thought the students would think they would know about, something that was in the news, and certainly there's no better time to be an environmental historian than in the last few years, perhaps, when the public discussion about climate change has been so present that even if you don't watch the news or read the newspaper regularly, you would notice it. And so we began with what the students thought they knew, and then we took that apart. So climate change, we're looking at the globe initially, and then we looked at, as I said, agriculture and energy and cities. So we broke it down, always relating back to climate change. And I'm not quite sure that we realized that when we designed the course that all of the subsequent themes that we covered would fit back in, would feed back in to the debate about climate change, but they kind of nicely did. But that raised another question for me, at least, that I'm still struggling with. It's still very much a modern course. Mm-hmm. I mean, for all, you know, we talked about, where is he here? Here he is, Jared Diamond, you know, 13,000 years of human history. We did talk about this in the early lecture. It was primarily a course that dealt with the modern world. And by that, I mean the industrialized mm-hmm. world. So mid-19th century to the end of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I feel somewhat uncomfortable with that. So it's kind of like, and then the earth cooled. But then we had the steam engine. I mean, we kind of fast forward. And so, you know, that's why I asked the question about temporal scale, because there is so much interesting work that does start with the huge sweep of time. But really, when it comes down to it, and certainly when I teach the North American course, my time frame is going to be quite narrow compared to what it might be. Could be it might be the 20th century, like McNeil's book,
mm-hmm.
which is also kind of a model for, I think, for setting up a survey
back
course.
Into the early
19th it does.
Just yeah. Appropriately.
It's the long 20th century.
Well, maybe
so
we,
do we want to, I don't know,
move on to the second
sure,
question here,
which
then.
Is no easier.
Which is Eagle's question.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Here we go. Where's my question? So I actually came up with a question that was informed by my thinking about other non-environmental historical courses, but I think this is relevant to any courses that you're trying to reconceptualize. And so my question was, what sorts of concepts and critical thinking skills is environmental history particularly well suited to deliver? Put another way, what might students get out of an environmental history course that they might not be able to get as effectively from other history courses? And if we can agree that environmental history does offer particular methodological and conceptual insights, how might we organize our classes to best deliver these skills and methodologies?
I take it the silence means this is a particularly good question.
Well, do you want me to jump
sure.
in?
Sure.
I mean, my basic response to the first question about kind of key concepts and critical thinking skills that environmental history is particularly well suited to, it seems to me that it's an integrative field. And what's challenging for students, what's exciting about the field, is that they're forced to think about problems that they thought they might be familiar with in unconventional ways and introduce them to other bodies of knowledge that, because of the way university curricula are structured, because of the ways in which we stream students through disciplines, they might not necessarily approach on their own. This means, in my case, geography students who are well-trained, say, in physical geography are encountering historical texts in a fresh way. It might mean history students are encountering some scientific material that they might not otherwise get a chance to approach. And that can be daunting and intimidating, and it can be done poorly, too, should be added. But I think that's what's really exciting and valuable about it. I think also it's that integrative approach is materialist in conception. I don't mean that in a kind of historical materialist sense, although it might be that too. But it doesn't only deal with a kind of textual analysis or a cultural analysis. It also makes the assumption that there's a physical world that has mm-hmm. changes that occur that are affected by humans, but have a set of dynamics that are independent of humans too. And I think that stream of thought does run through environmental history. It's contested, but it's an approach which I think fell back somewhat maybe over the last few decades and has been reasserted in part by environmental history. And I think that's an important contribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just picking up on that, it was interesting. Eagle and I were at a comprehensive exam a few weeks ago, and some of the very issues that Matthew just brought up were discussed there. And I think there is an argument to be made that environmental history offers students, whether undergraduates or graduate students, a particular opportunity to explore, I suppose, looked at this way, the limits of social construction. And given the trajectory of historiography, both in history but in the humanities and social sciences generally, towards discursive analyses of power and the social construction of reality, that environmental history offers us an opportunity to see how far we can go with that before we come up against the material nature of the physical environment, and I think it's very interesting that there has been a swing in other kinds of history, in gender history is what I'm thinking of particularly, between social constructivist understandings of gender to biological ones, and we've swung back and forth, and I think we have an opportunity here through the kind of history that we teach to bring students up against those conundrums and to start looking at how historians have constructed boundaries between us, not us, humans and non-human nature, between and kind of play with that and see how far we can go and what we can learn from both those perspectives.
Mm-hmm. I really like this question, and it's probably one of the more difficult ones to try and formulate an answer, but I guess one of the things in terms of structuring the course that I had hoped to achieve was to provide some moments where students would read research in the field of environmental history that would provide a different lens on thinking about a traditional historical event. So I always think of Crosby and ecological mm-hmm. imperialism as one of the most effective ideas in environmental history that changes the way we think about past events mm-hmm. Or in the way we have thought about past events. And so I think this is one of the strengths of environmental history that I'd like to try and push further in my teaching, and that is getting students to think not just about non-human natural actors in historical events, but also human beings as biological agents. Mm-hmm. And not in every instance, this doesn't always change the way we think about past events, but if we take Ted Steinberg's chapter on the Civil War in his textbook, he applies a biological lens to the Civil War that tells a different story. And so I think that's what I'd like to try and do more in my teaching, is see how environmental history can tell these stories in national histories differently mm-hmm. because it's applying a different lens, a biological lens, to studying the past.
And to be honest, it's only by doing that we will convince our colleagues who work in other kinds of history that of the centrality of the environment as a lens through which to look at the past. It's if we can tell them how this kind of history will change how they teach their survey courses in, you know, the history of Canada, the history of the United States, all those sorts of things. So I do think that you're onto something there. And I've just started to think about my graduate course, and I'm kind of designing it that way. I want to talk to students about what environmental history has to offer to some of the large historical questions that we all encounter. What does environmental historians have to say about causality, about agency, which is mm-hmm. which gets to ecological imperialism and who's an agent, and how can we see agency much differently? And those are questions that interest all of us, no matter what kind of history that we do. And students as well.
And I think in the last few decades, you know, there's been a move away from single grand narratives, you know, the questioning of the grand narrative in all fields of history. And one thing that I myself find particularly compelling within the field of environmental history is the focus in many cases on the extreme complexity of ecological systems. And so that sometimes you know, you end up with kind of unintended consequence. You change one aspect of the system, and then you have a whole slew of ramifications that are unexpected, unintended consequences, or as Donald Rumsfeld once put it, the unknown unknowns, and as opposed to the known unknowns, and mm-hmm. et cetera. I think that through certain case studies in environmental history that point to the complexity of ecological systems, you're teaching students to look for those complexities in all kinds of systems, be they mm-hmm. ecological or could be social arrangements in general, to be looking for the unintended consequences, for, as David Blackburn put it in his book, The Conquest of Nature, you know, the winners and losers when certain choices are made, be they you know, choices about nature or about public policy or whatever, and that often you have to look quite hard and deep to see who some of those winners and losers are over time and over space. So mm-hmm. I think there's a set of questions there that environmental history is well suited to mm-hmm. getting students to explore, if not singularly suited to doing so.
And I was going to say, and I think I was just thinking more about this agency thing. Perhaps this just reflects the last thing that I read, but I think in addition to getting students to think about the range of historical agents, that you know, honeybees are historical agents just like humans are, I think it also, in the best situations, helps us think about human agency very differently. I'm thinking about the work that Ellen Stroud does about dead bodies, or Nancy Langston, that humans are actually are ecological actors, mm-hmm. Whether they know it or not. So Stroud talks about what happens when bodies are buried or cremated, and they're actually that, and she treats human bodies as, you know, form of pollution, as something that can affect air quality, for instance. Or in Langston's case, when she's talking about hormones, I can't remember which one, endocrine disruptors, and or just the drugs that we consume that end up being washed out into the Strait of Georgia out there, and how that is actually shaping the ecology of an ecosystem that we don't see and we have no sense of. So human beings as being part of nature is, and that through that sense, being agents in a very different way, is something that's quite interesting, would be quite interesting to get students to explore.
Yeah. I wanted to pick up on a point Matthew had made earlier about teaching interdisciplinary skills. And on a practical level, for some of my students, teaching them where the science library is on campus and what kind of sources that you can get in there to broaden your net as you're going out and working on a research paper, that you don't have to be restricted to using the social sciences and humanities library to do your research, that you should branch out and try and tap into other disciplines. And also to spend a little bit of time talking about and discussing the pitfalls of interdisciplinary research, especially drawing from natural sciences and the complexities of the relationship between sciences and humanities, and how we utilize natural science research in environmental history research. And so we did a few readings on that, and we talked about some of the issues that came up, and then several students went and branched out and did some interdisciplinary research to apply research in the natural sciences to a question or problem in humanities and social sciences. So.
One unrelated point that I think comes under the this question is I've found students have changed over time too, and their ideas, of course, and their ideas of the environment and of nature change too. And when I first started teaching around 2000, I was always able to depend on a good seminar dealing with the problem of wilderness and debates about the history of the wilderness ideal, and students mm-hmm. would become impassioned in predictable ways, and we'd have a lively debate, and there'd be a learning outcome at the end of the seminar. This no longer happens for me. When I've assigned Cronin's essay on the trouble with wilderness in recent years, it is not as well received, by which I mean it hasn't excited students. They don't see the debate at the core of it, because they all come in with the assumption that wilderness is a social construction. And they're much interested in moving beyond any debate about wilderness and talking about the history of sustainability, which has been come as a bit of a surprise to me. So I've had to adapt in midstream, as it were, in the middle of seminars, to try and explain why I thought they might find this an interesting topic. But that has been a real surprise for me in recent years, and I wonder if others have found a similar reaction. Or
I found the exact same thing this year. We almost had to deal with the trouble of wilderness as a historical document, and why this
really?
Essay was such a big deal when it was first published, and why there was such backlash against it from certain groups. And I had the exact same phenomenon. All my students came in with basically, no duh. We get it. We know that wilderness is a social construction. And so we did have a pretty good discussion as to why, at the time at which this essay was first published, that it was so significant and how it changed thinking about wilderness. And so then the question then became, what do I do now? Where do we go from there? Where does the discussion turn to next? And maybe your students are directing you in some good directions for how to deal with that.
Well, no, I haven't had the same experience, but maybe it's because I haven't taught an upper division environmental history course. So I'm wondering if by the time they get to third and fourth year, they have become familiar with, they know what social construction is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the 17 and 18 year olds in my class, who come from both the arts and the sciences, because that's the nature of that course, to draw widely, whether they would they would be so blasé about about that or not. I'd like to think in the 2 years that it's taken for them to get to you that we've taught them about social construction. It's hegemonic by the time we get to the third year, I don't know.
In my tutorial in History 105,
right.
The course that we co-taught
we taught
a few years ago,
we taught
Trouble with Wilderness, and I've got to say that many of my students had a quite uncritical understanding of the term wilderness. So maybe they might have by the end of the discussion realized, yeah, they had thought a bit about the sort of this idea of wilderness as a cultural construction, but they hadn't thought explicitly about it too much. So I think we had a relatively successful discussion connecting this particular article and a set of thoughts that they might have had out there.
I'm wondering if, so from your perspective, they were completely nonplussed. They already figured out that this was a social construction. I was just wondering if wilderness didn't resonate with them at all as a concept. Because I just finished reading Richard Love's book called Last Child in the Woods, which is, he's invented this, you probably know this, or both of you, as parents. He's got this concept of nature deficit disorder. And it's really about how kids these days, kids these days don't spend time in the woods in the way that they do not have the same access to nature as their parents and certainly not their grandparents had. And so it's a completely alien concept. So wilderness would kind of be, like another environment as you made in SimCity or something. It's all virtual, in other words, because of the way they've grown up. I don't know if wilderness resonates as a concept for them at all. At least Richard Love would say no. It's because of how they've grown up. It's just a foreign country.
I had the same expectation that Matthew had, that we were going to have a moment of unpacking the trouble with wilderness and discussing the idea of nature as a social construction. And what we ended up doing was very briefly getting to that point, and then working in the opposite direction and talking about materiality and how to grapple with materiality in history and where are the limits of the social construction of nature. And so I think we ended up having a useful discussion on it, but perhaps in a different way than I had initially thought it was going to go.
Hmm.
Maybe now's a good time to move into Matthew's question.
Sure.
Is it easier?
I think we ended with the easiest. I was just asking the question of what kind of term assignments should we be setting in environment-hosted courses? Are there good essay questions that lead students in the right directions? Are essay assignments the way to go? How should we organize this course?
This is a great question. I assigned two assignments for the one-term course in North American Environmental History, and in the end, it was a bit of an experiment. I gave them a very large research paper as the assignment, which is pretty traditional assignment. They were almost open topic. There was about seven themes in environmental history that they could choose from just to make sure that the paper topics were going to stay within some sort of coherence close to environmental history as possible. And they had an earlier shorter assignment, which was a primary document analysis assignment. And so that the first assignment I was satisfied with because in part I was striving to achieve a more general history assignment that was going to have students deal with primary sources and discussing how to analyze primary sources, but one that would also address specific questions to environmental history. How do we take a document that may have been used to study, say, settlement in New France? What is it that an environmental historian might see in that document that's different from a historian of French imperialism? So that I was satisfied with that assignment. The research assignment I was maybe less satisfied with because it was a bit too big, I think, and while it gave some students a lot of freedom to do what they wanted, I'm not sure that it had enough, and maybe this is fine, that it didn't have a guided purpose, that there was a strict outcome that I had expected. It was more of an open outcome, and I got a very good array of outcomes for my students. But my goals for it were to have students do primary research on a topic that was original or near original as possible.
I particularly like that first assignment that you described where you had a set of primary sources around a particular topic or theme and had them make sense of them, I guess, is what you have in mind. Because we were talking before about how interdisciplinary actually environmental history is as a subfield, and you could have such a really wide range of sources about a particular event, phenomenon, whatever, scientific data. You could have descriptions of, diary descriptions, government documents, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that is an opportunity to not only expose students to the interdisciplinarity of environmental history as a subfield, but also to think about this question of the construction, I guess, of narratives out of evidence and even perhaps conflicting evidence or different kinds of evidence that tell different stories.
Yeah.
I think that's a really neat assignment.
The big challenge in the primary document analysis assignment was developing strategies for deriving knowledge of past nature, past non-human actors from documents that are produced by people. And so one of the big questions as they looked at a report by Samuel de Champlain in 1618, I think, was to determine what you can know about the landscape or nature in New France in the early 17th century from a report written by Champlain, or what can you know about smallpox from an oral history from a Plains Native group that was recorded in 1962 but was an oral tradition carried from the mid-19th century up. And so that was the big challenge, was how do we read non-human actors out of documents that are produced by human actors themselves? Nature doesn't make its own documents unless we go out into the woods and start doing some field research, which I wonder if anyone's done an assignment that gets students out of the classroom.
We have to ask the geography department person.
You won't be able to hear this, but I'm rolling my eyes right now.
The mics aren't that high quality.
I'm leaving in 2 weeks to lead a field course over a week in Alberta. And I'm rolling my eyes, not because I'm not looking forward to it. It's going to be great. But there are so many details to put in place if you plan anything beyond a one-day field trip. Getting vehicles, booking rooms, booking times with people to visit various sites. But one of the great strengths, it seems to me, of an environmental history or historical geographical approach is that you have this opportunity to take students into different settings outside of the classroom for kind of experience-based learning opportunities. And I've been involved with a whole host of different field trips, some locally, some up the Fraser River. And it is surprising the different kinds of lessons that can be taught in an actual site compared to in a classroom setting, poring over some text. I mean, you have to plan a lot in advance. You have to know a good deal about the places you're going. It's not much use if you're randomly casting about and walking around in the woods. Although exploratory field trips can work sometimes too. But how you build an assignment around a field trip is a different kind of question. I don't think I have the answer to that. I mean, you can set up various exercises that students can do, set a problem that will have to be grappled with and interpreted and dealt with in a field setting. You might provide, say, historical photographs of the site and then visit the site and ask the students to try and write a thought piece about what has changed at the site over time and whether there's any way of explaining that change over time. But field trips and field schools are a great opportunity.
Sean, you led a field trip last fall to Stanley Park, and it was in conjunction with a talk that you gave at UBC. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how that might be something that kind of a field trip might be something that could be integrated into your teaching. It was a wonderful experience for those of us outside mm-hmm. of the classroom who were simply interested to have. But I'm wondering if that gave you any ideas for teaching.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I wasn't sure how much the field itself was backdrop to stories that I was telling in what I would tell in a lecture structure, or how much being actually on the ground was making a difference. I guess I would have to ask students
it
if I took them out.
I was on that field trip, so I can answer. I was one of your students.
Oh, there we go.
it makes a big difference because you can. Things are constantly changing. You can experience things in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing a slide of a site is very different from being there, poking
there.
Around and being able to ask questions about it. And
yeah.
It breaks up the classic lecture because there's constant interaction and discussion.
I guess one of the big advantages on that field trip were when we got into the deeper trails that there were legacy trees, mm-hmm. trees that had evidence of some of the historical events that I was talking about. And so you can very quickly make these connections between an event that happens in the 1930s to the present because you're standing next to the tree that was there for all of those events, or you're on a trail that experienced a certain number of changes that were discussed over time. So yeah, I guess being out in the field, especially if you can incorporate some local history into your teaching, can be very advantageous. What about the big survey courses?
Well, I was thinking of that. I was, before we started recording, I guess I was talking to some of you about how I will have 180 students, so there's a logistical problem right there. So on Friday, I met with Mark Bomford, who's the director of the UBC Farm, and he routinely has very large classes go down there. And as this course, this Global Environments course, teaches a whole section on agriculture, I thought, is there not a way to include the farm in my teaching? And so we were speaking about that, and I think what is going to happen at the very least is that they will have classroom time. I will talk about the origins of agriculture and industrial agriculture, the Green Revolution, and I spend a good deal of time talking about the history of alternative agriculture, the history of the organic movement. And that will segue nicely with the farm and how the farm has tried to position itself as an alternative to mainstream agriculture, a place where people can find out about Albert Howard and the indoor method of composting and non-chemical ways of pest control. So my idea is that I will provide the historical context. They will then spend an hour and a half, all of our class time, down at the farm, seeing how some of these ideas, which have a long history, are being acted on today in a very different political context. So it's the thing about, it's the history part that's hard, right? We can take them out to Stanley Park, we can take them out to different places, but kind of using those places to make them reflect about the past, I think I see as the challenge. And that's how mm-hmm. I hope to do that, so they can have an experience with a working farm now that's setting itself up as organic and alternative, and use that, I hope, to think about the broader history that they've been hearing about in their whole relationship between people and nature and the particular political and economic context in which that occurs. So that's the big... So all of us are going to go down there. I hope it doesn't rain. and then there are opportunities if I had a smaller class to get their hands dirty actually doing that. But still, the history part would still be a question. I mean, we could do a little bit about just some of the things he was talking about in our talk, you know, change over time in that site, mm-hmm. you know, and changes in the soil and tillage and you know, the forest and all of that. So, but that would be only possible with a much smaller group. I mean, as in less than 180.
And that brings up an issue that came up with the large assignment that I gave my students, the research paper. And, you know, hopefully each year you learn something from your students as they guide you to how you're going to change your courses in the future. And what I found was that a large number of my students gravitated to issues of environmental problems of the near past. And so to me, initially, this was a bit of a surprise as I was knee deep in studying 19th century pigs in Winnipeg. And I thought that was super cool. And I thought my students would all be interested in studying something in the distant past. But they were keenly interested in studying very contemporary environmental movements. Came to me on numerous occasions to ask me whether that was appropriate for a history mm-hmm. course. And if it was, how to make it a history paper.
Mm-hmm.
I had several conversations with students about strategies for historicizing a contemporary environmental case study. So I had a student who was doing a paper on the Olympic Village in Vancouver and the idea of sustainability. Mm-hmm. And so I had her do some research on, first of all, that plot of land in the Lower Mainland and how it's changed over time and the history of the idea of sustainability and some stuff on the emergence of the modern environmental movement and its relationship to British Columbia. And so I think she was able to effectively historicize a contemporary problem, but I wondered afterward whether that was satisfactory for an environmental history course.
I think the idea of a biography of a place is a really good way to go. Mm-hmm. And I get my best ideas by stealing them from other people. So I was looking at Bill Cronin's website, and he's got some, and his syllabi are there. And one of the new assignments that he's got is to have his students, and these are undergraduate students, do a biography of a place. And so just the first step, find out what kinds of documents are available, have been generated by your place, census material, surveys,
fire insurance maps,
perhaps diaries or biographies of people who might have lived in whatever place that you've chosen. And so, and they went from there, and it was, I mean, because they chose their places based on their own affiliation with them, right? So there was a very much a present day interest, and then they just looked at this plot of land, this section on the prairie, whatever, and tried to trace it back as far as they could, and to see how much of a human history it had, because of course recognizing that these records are generated by people for particular reasons was also very useful to them. So I think it's completely appropriate.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the time students will have some contemporary hook too. They'll be interested in a current issue and they want to know its background, and that's entirely legitimate, and it may be the way that you draw them into thinking in an environmental historical mode.
Mm-hmm.
Just following up on the place-based essay idea, Michael Lewis wrote a really interesting essay a few years back in environmental history. I think it was entitled, "This Class Will Write a Book." And what he did was he organized his fourth year seminar to write a local history of their college town in Pennsylvania, in environmental history. Or, no, sorry, of the river running through the college town.
Right.
And the students all got organized. They interviewed some city officials, plumbed the depths of the local archival base, and collectively pieced out the work to write different sections of it. And I tried
you
to do
that.
Something similar to that this past year. But it's something you can only do with a small seminar. But The idea here was to have a group project where there was a contemporary hook. In this case, it was the debate over building another dam on the Peace River at Site C, and then working out what kinds of historical background, sociological analysis, environmental history would be helpful in understanding this dispute. And then the students kind of ran with it, did research on the different parts, wrote team papers, which we then compressed into copy that would be possible to put on a website, and then they designed a website, and we put it all together and lodged a website at the end of it. There, it seemed to me, it was very helpful to have a contemporary hook and a different mode of output, sorry for the word, at the end of the course besides an essay. They've all written essays. They know the drill. They didn't seem particularly excited by the idea of an essay project, but a website that their friends could see, that was a little more, that might contribute to public debate, that was a little more interesting to them. And so my sense was, we'd have to ask them, but my sense was that they were a little more excited about the project than they would have been the classic essay assignment. But
I like that. I tried to do that in 105, the non-essay the non-essay assignment. They have to write one essay. There's just no getting around that. But for the same, this was one of my innovations this year, that now that I was teaching it on my own. The second assignment was they had the option of writing a conventional essay, but they could also do something unconventional that addressed the same topic. So again, I'm thinking that at the end of the year people are tired. Having learned all the history, I asked them, they could choose one of two very broad questions. One was to reflect on their own relationship with the car, and this was in the context of learning about Wolfgang Schivelbusch and the annihilation of space and time, you know, industrialization. They could do an assignment based on their relationship with the car with that historical knowledge behind them, or they could do a similar thing about garbage. And I got rap music, I got a film, I got art, I got poetry, and it was all quite fantastic. And they probably spent 10 times as much time on these assignments that were worth exactly the same thing as the first one was, but they will remember that. And how much history, strictly speaking, history learning happened, I'm not sure, but at a certain point I stopped caring about that, because they were actually engaged in thinking about their relationship with the environment through these two some of them went in critical mass and filmed it, you know, with a little webcam on the helmet, and then wrote about what that told them about the car over time in the context in which we learned. So I'm all for non-conventional assignments, and I'm in the process now of putting together a website of student projects to both inspire next year's students, but also because this year's students were so keen on this, because they want to see their work and share it with other people. They want to show their parents.
One thing that did emerge too, though, is the anxiety they all have about assessment, and then the problem that forces upon me too, what marks to give for this sort of thing. And so in our case, we had to have sort of discussions about the apportionment of marks for different assignments. They would write a journal independently. They would assess their team members. So there were various moments in the course where they could write self-assessments, where they were getting marks on individual work as well as teamwork, but that all had to be worked out and negotiated.
Mm-hmm. Those are some really good ideas. Maybe we can give a few more good ideas about textbooks. What textbooks do you use for your courses on environmental history? And so maybe we can start by talking about what textbooks we use, and then maybe move on to talk about what textbooks we wish we could use, what we'd like to see in future textbooks as new publications are in the works and will come out down the road.
Well, Eli and I did not use a textbook for the first year course, The Global Environment. What we did do, and I continue to do this year, was simply to assign readings, but they were readings that were really about the contemporary environmental situation. So they feeling that this was a first year course that was meant to get them excited about history and an area, that was okay, that we would deliver the historical content. So I use textbooks in writing my lectures, But they did not read a history textbook. They read a whole bunch of other things that we picked and chose from a variety of media.
Okay.
But I would say that in my what did I use a lot? A couple of things. One of which was Ted Steinberg's Down to Earth, picking and choosing bits and pieces from that. The Canadian stuff is a bit more difficult, but because this was a global course, that mattered less, because I was choosing from all over the place.
Right.
I have to admit, I've never used a textbook in any course, and not because I have anything against textbooks, but none seem to fit the courses I teach, and so I've always depended on a reading pack of one kind or another, and the students seem to appreciate not having to spend the money on a textbook. Many nevertheless complain that they would like a textbook, particularly at the first year level, where there are concerns about getting all the material down in a lecture. I don't think there's any solution. I don't know whether there are any textbooks on the horizon that would address this issue of a course in Canadian environmental history or environmental history with a Canadian bent in a global context. There are several options on the market right now. None of the courses I teach are strictly environmental history. That's my problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I do courses in historical geography of Canada and global historical geography. And so none of the current textbooks really cover enough of what I'm doing to warrant their adoption.
And other than this introductory global contemporary issues course that Tina and I taught a couple of years ago, I haven't taught an environmental history survey, and even if I did, I probably would not be inclined to use a textbook. Mm-hmm. I would probably use a course reader as well. I should say I taught a graduate course on global environmental history. It was really just a set of topics that interested me and the graduate students, as the seminars often are. Mm-hmm. But we did actually have something of we had two texts. We had David Blackburn's The Conquest of Nature, which is about Germany, but addresses issues surrounding, you want to call it, modernization and the environment that are, I think, relevant throughout Europe and elsewhere. And that worked quite well. Blackburn, not himself originally an environmental historian, but more of a kind of a social cultural historian, I think did a particularly good job of pointing to the connection between the exertion of power over or on nature and on people, that these processes were connected, I guess is a way to put it. And I thought that worked well, and I could divide that book into a series of thematic parts that fit with things like, you know, dams and water and you know, the modernization of agriculture and, you know, and actually it being Germany, you know, you've also got genocide. And so thinking about how ideas about landscape relate to ideas about racial others, as some might put it. And then we also used McNeil's Something New Under the Sun, which we read not as a kind of survey text, but actually to think about how one might write a global environmental history of the 20th century. Being a graduate course, we were kind of concerned in the methodology involved. And we did, for History 105, use a few excerpts from
that
book. But again, it's hard to fit any textbook, even a good one like McNeil's, to one's own, you know, image or idea of how a course should be organized. That was I think our biggest problem.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a challenge in almost any course, of whether the textbook that you're looking at is going to fit what you actually want to teach, and how much will the textbook inform the structure of the course. I ended up assigning Steinberg's Down to Earth as a narrative text for the students, as a backbone to follow my attempt at telling a story of North American environmental history. And I found that textbook quite satisfying, and achieved that to quite good effect. And while it focused on American history, the role of nature in American history, it was useful for a North American course. But as I have found, it's difficult to draw Canadian material for a course in North American environmental history. There were some themes where there wasn't a satisfactory reading that I could assign for a Canadian context. I did use Method and Meaning in Canadian Environmental History as a supplementary reader, almost. It's a collection of original essays by luminaries in the field of Canadian environmental history, like Matthew Evenden. and
available
this was very useful.
Better bookstores everywhere, folks.
This was very useful for our classroom discussions. We would I would try and peg one of these essays to one of the larger themes of the week that fit with the narrative structure of Steinberg's book, to have a Canadian case to apply to the larger issue that we were dealing with, whether it was urbanization or whether it was water or whether it was hydroelectricity. And so that was a good complement, but in that sense, there wasn't a Canadian textbook that gave me a satisfactory narrative that I could use in a one-term course, at least that I found in this instance, but Steinberg seemed to fit fairly well.
And I guess there are other readers available now, and then there's Graham Wynn's long-term kind of sweeping environmental history survey, Canada and Arctic.
Tina is showing it to us now.
But again, it all depends on the course you're teaching.
Yeah.
The course I teach is historical geography since Confederation.
Right.
Graham's book covers
everything
since ice melting and plant recolonization of the North. And
mm-hmm.
so, again, when it's a textbook with a heavy price tag attached, you have to think hard about whether you can assign it.
Yes, practical considerations mm-hmm. to think about.
Yeah.
Well, I think that brings us to a conclusion. I want to thank everybody for spending a little time to talk about teaching. Hopefully we've started a bit of a discussion with our listeners. Thank you, Tina.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you, Eagle. And thank you, Matthew.
Sorry I was late.
Canadian environmental history is a relatively recent field of study, and so it's also new to course calendars at universities across the country. There are only a handful of general textbooks on the subject, including Chad and Pamela Gaffield's Consuming Canada, David Freeland Duke's Canadian Environmental History, and Graham Wynn's recently published book Canada and Arctic North America. Professors Alan McEachern and Bill Turkell from the Department of History at the University of Western Ontario have recently edited a new textbook called Method and Meaning in Canadian Environmental History. I spoke with Professor McEachern to find out more about this book.
Hi, this is Alan McEachern. I teach history at the University of Western Ontario.
Welcome to the podcast, Alan. I wanted to start by asking you, what were the origins of the textbook project for Method and Meaning in Canadian Environmental History?
I had been approached by Laura McLeod, an editor, about putting together a textbook in environmental history, and I took it to I'd been involved in Niche for a couple of years, and I contacted the other people in the core group of Niche, which were Bill Turkell, Matthew Evenden, Stefan Kasungi, and Colin Coates, and we kind of threw around the idea of what a good textbook might look like. I think we came to the realization pretty quickly that we didn't want to do a greatest hits sort of snapshot of what we considered the best work in the field to date, because we felt there were a couple of good books that already did that, Gaffield and Gaffield's Consuming Canada, and David Duke's Reader in Canadian Environmental History.
Right.
What we wanted to do instead was to spur new writing, new thinking instead, and since Bill Turkell and I seemed especially interested in pushing forward a textbook, we decided we would co-edit it.
So what were the larger goals or objectives for this textbook that set it apart from earlier collected works in Canadian environmental history?
Well, let me see. Bill and I, pretty quickly when we talked things over, we realized we wanted to accomplish a few things. We wanted to see if we could create a reader where the contributors talk to each other, that as much as possible that their work fed off each other. So we invited what we considered kind of a dream team of scholars in the field. I think we invited 17 or something to meet in Toronto in June of 2006 and discuss how their contributions would work towards a reader in environmental history. We would have liked, by the way, I should say, we would have liked to have twice as many contributors, but we were trying to balance things like time periods, topics, regional specializations. And we were really encouraged by how much interest there was in the project. I think only two people eventually turned us down. So we were looking for to create a reader where the contributors were talking to each other. That's one thing. We also wanted explicitly to engage methodology. We wanted to be teaching students how to do environmental history, and I think suggest ways of doing history more broadly. So one of the things we asked all the contributors of the book, we asked them to imagine students looking over their shoulder while they were doing their work, and so imagine explaining what they're doing, what choices they're making, and why along the way. That would be the second thing, I think. The third thing is that we wanted to show non-environmental history students and professors how to bring the methods and sources of environmental history to broader historical practice. Let me see. Oh, and four, we, of course, also wanted to offer appropriate coverage geographically, thematically, temporally, etc. As an editor of a reader, you quickly give the you quickly give up the book being all things to all people. You know, you realize you're not going to get in a chapter about the Klondike Gold Rush, even if you want to have one. But we certainly did try to seek as much balance as we could along the way.
And the textbook seems organized thematically, but you provide a geographical and temporal chart for readers to follow where in Canada they're reading about and when in Canada they're reading about.
That's right. That was actually the publisher Nelson's idea about how to kind of bring these different planes together, I guess, in a way.
So where do you see this textbook fitting in a course on Canadian environmental history?
Well, Bill and I would love it if it made its way into Canadian history courses, full stop, environmental or no. But we know that that's it's probably unlikely to happen. I think one of the things, one of the best things about environmental history for undergraduate history students, for humanities students, social science students, is, to my mind, it suggests the value of looking beyond only documentary historical sources. So, for example, engaging science, engaging scientists, for example, and that's one of the things that we try to get at in the book about how historians, you know, faculty, students, other practitioners, how history can benefit by looking outside of straightforward documentary sources. I don't think I should say straightforward. Documentary sources are not always so straightforward, but... Well, you know, we did try. It does cover pre-contact to the 21st century, so I would hope it could be used throughout either a half-year or full-year course,
right?
Introducing students new to environmental history. I think Canadian students and professors and North American students and professors are very spoiled these days in terms of access to essays. In a really good, positive way, not just because of their online availability, but also in the field of environmental history specifically, there's been just so much good work being written in and about Canada in the past decades. I guess my hope would just be that profs see some value in Method and Meaning as a useful reader for their students.
So what more would you like to see in terms of textbook publications on Canadian environmental history, given that this is only one of very few textbooks in Canadian environmental history to be published?
I would want to see big books. I'm not talking so much in terms of size, but in terms of aspiration. And I think that's true not just of textbooks, but of all publications in our field. I think we should be swinging for the fences a lot more than we have been. I think of when I was down, I was at a recent American Society for Environmental History conference, and a bunch of American parks historians were asking me, what's the big book on Banff? What book should I read on Banff? And I had to say, well, you know what? There is no book on Banff. I really didn't know what to recommend. That's one topic. I think that there's an awful lot. That's the exciting thing about Canadian environmental history right now, the field, is that there is so much there is so much room for good big topics, and I think that we should be swinging for the fences. So I think we need books. We need more single overarching monographs of the field or of subfields. I'd like to see more Canadian-American comparative works. I think that that could be really valuable. And I think, by the way, those works would probably sell some copies in the United States as well, which is, you know, for people who are trying to imagine an academic career, sometimes that's not such a bad thing to think about. I think we have underwritten topics in Canadian environmental history, like energy in particular and climate. They spring to mind. And I guess I just generally think that we should be trying to write books that take chances, whatever kind of chances those might be.
Well, those sound like some great ideas. Thank you for joining us on the podcast and letting us know a little bit more about method and meaning in Canadian environmental history.
Well, thanks, Sean.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Networking Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Tina Liu, Eagle Glassheim, Matthew Evenden, Alan McEachern, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche.uwo.ca/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche.uwo.ca. Follow Niche on Twitter at twitter.com/niche_Canada. Thanks for listening, and be sure to download our next episode.